This is a download from the BBC. The programme may have been edited for copyright reasons. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. Good morning. On Excess Baggage today, ethical tourism. Picking up on our recent discussion about sustainable travel, a personal view of how we might travel more responsibly, with particular regard to freedom of expression and human rights. And not-so-ethical tourism. To commemorate the centenary of the death of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, we look at the real story behind the myths and explore a wild and ravishing area of Bolivia doing so. With me to talk Butch and Sundance, the journalist, writer and broadcaster, John Pilkington. Welcome, John. Most people are familiar with the story of Butch and Sundance, I guess, from that movie with Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Paul Newman's recent death may have rekindled interest. It's such a powerful myth of these two lovable outlaws. How accurate was the film?
Well, it's the last scene that everybody remembers, isn't it? When Butch and Sundance are surrounded by what seems like the entire Bolivian army. The truth was that there were three soldiers and a policeman up against them. One of the soldiers retreated wounded. The policeman ran away. So effectively, it was two against two. But they were cornered and they had reached the end of the road. They realised it. And, well, the film doesn't actually... It leaves us guessing what happened to them in the end. But what most people agree happened to them was that, realising the game was up, they shot each other.
So they thought the end of the literally was the end of the game.
Well, it had, because of course the penalty for what they'd done, the hold up they'd committed, and wounding the soldier would have been hanging.
I have to admit that as a youngster, I had a book called The Pictorial History of the Wild West, which covered in great detail the story of Butch Cassidy, the Sundance Kid, and their gang, which were the gang they had when they were still in North America, the Wild Bunch, which was, you know, if you like, a classic boys' Wild West fable. But there seems to be, looking at the film and then reading more serious history, more adult history, a fair degree of truth. What is the appeal, do you think, of their particular story?
Well, the film was pretty accurate. I mean, Butch was an extremely decent robber. Sundance, perhaps not quite so much, but it's absolutely true that by 1901 they had robbed a dozen banks and countless Union Pacific trains in the Midwest, and they had Pinkerton's detectives chasing them, running them all over the Midwestern states. They escaped by the skins of their teeth to South America, by steamship to Buenos Aires, where they decided to go straight. Mm-hmm. And all that is in the film. It is absolutely correct. They bought some land up in the Andes in northern Patagonia. They bought some cattle and they became highly respected cattle ranchers, much highly regarded by their neighbours there for more than 5 years. But then in 1905, they couldn't resist it any longer. They had to go and rob a bank. Again!
Now, how do we know this? Because it's a fascinating story, but you, for all I know, you might be making it up as you go along. it's interesting as it unfolds, the way that they were beginning to be tracked down. The days of the bandits in the Wild West in the United States was over. The Pinkerton's agency you mentioned was tracking these people down. Law enforcement communications were really pushing these people to the wall. So they fled, as you say, Butch and Sundance, to South America. But how did the trail get picked up again? Why did they turn to criminality?
Why did they turn to criminality again? Well, I think it was just in their blood. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it was one last attempt to perhaps set themselves up more permanently. But either way, the robbers of the bank down in Rio Gallego in the far south of Patagonia matched the descriptions, and a wanted poster was put out by the Argentine police authorities, and I've seen that poster. It's absolutely, the picture of Butch is absolutely spot on. And they escaped yet again by the skins of their teeth. They left behind their land, the log cabin they'd built in Patagonia, all their cattle, escaped over to Chile, then up to Bolivia, where in the closing months of 1908 they fetched up in the sleepy a Bolivian border town of Tupisa. Tupisa was Sleepy Town then, Sleepy Town now, actually. It hasn't changed
Tell me
much.
About it, because we're talking about them covering a huge amount of ground, moving from northern Patagonia, way down in the southern Argentina, right up to Bolivia.
That's right, yes.
I mean, they were used to being on the run, but this was covering different terrain.
Yeah, but over 3 years. Remember, right. They left Patagonia early 1906, and they worked, actually. They went straight again, working in a moment of wonderful irony. They were hired as payroll guards by a Bolivian tin mining company. And eventually they left that job, and they were planning yet another hold-up. In fact, they were planning to rob the bank in Tupisa, when, unfortunately for them, the Bolivian army came in and was... some of them were barracked in the building next to the bank. So wisely, I think, Butch and Sundance turned their attention to a payroll consignment belonging to the Aramayo Franque tin mining company. Now, in that part of Bolivia, tin was at its height in those days. Sure. Bolivia was built on tin in more ways than one. And a miner's wage wasn't great, but there were an awful lot of them, and they were all paid weekly in cash.
Right.
So large amounts of money going backwards and forwards across the high altiplano of southwest Bolivia. And would you believe nobody had ever tried to rob those pack horse trains before?
So these guys were really bringing a product from the States, or importing something
they
new.
They were importing their, not so much a product, more a lifestyle choice,
yeah.
I think. And so they were unguarded, and on the morning of the 4th of November, 100 years ago next week, Butch and Sundance lay in wait for this. It was just one man and four mules. The man was called Carlos Pero, and according to his report to his employers, they held him up and took the money in an extremely polite manner. Well, Butch could afford to be polite. He was holding the gun, of course, but it was his hallmark, his decency, his politeness, his charm, even when he was taking all your money. But then everything went wrong. The man they robbed met an express courier going south. The news got back to Tupisa. Within hours, posses were being sent out, scouring the altiplano.
Tell me a bit about the landscape of this area. You know, what were the communications like? This is very rugged,
mountainous
terrain.
It is important to know. I call it the altiplano. Mm-hmm. It is, in fact, a badland landscape in that part of Bolivia, which they would have been very much at home in. Cacti, organ pipe cacti everywhere, high rocky outcrops, plenty of hiding places, caves and hideaways, roamed by llamas in the case of Bolivia. Of course, in the Midwest, it was cattle, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That would be the only difference. And it's not surprising that they ended up there, really. It was very much a home from home.
I mean, I've once had the experience of riding on a horse through the Andes. This was in Chile rather than in Bolivia, and the sense of being so far away from everything in what you describe as badland territory was very powerful. I imagine, as you say, they must have felt in a way very at home there.
It was
a wilderness, and you know, they would have seen anybody else coming from a long distance.
At home and safe, because, as you say, distances are vast. And so it was really bad luck. I feel so sorry for them that the news got out so quickly. And the mining company carried massive clout in Tupisa. Mm-hmm. It was a big employer. So it didn't take long for them to get posses of police, of soldiers and of company employees looking for them. They roamed they zigzagged across the altiplano for all that day and most of the following day before fetching up exhausted on the evening of the 6th of November in a tiny, now it's a mining town, but then it was just a hamlet called San Vicente. Mm-hmm. San Vicente is the highest populated place in Bolivia, which must make it just about the highest. I was there for 2 days and the temperature never rose above -7 Celsius. It was a godforsaken place, a freezing place, a hellish place to live.
Someone, would you recommend it? I must ask you, you know, what, the places you visited that Butch and Sundance frequented, where would you advise me, I haven't been to Bolivia, to go of these places? Is there a tourist trail that can follow the bandits' trail?
It's just beginning, actually. I'm very proud to say that when I turned up a few years ago, there's an enterprising lady in Tupiza who runs Butch and Sundance Tours, and she was taking her clients to the hold-up site, but it was the wrong place. So between me and a local journalist, and of course I had some information with me from American outlaw historians, we found the right place. And so if you go to Tupiza, and anyone will point you in the direction of the Butch and Sundance
Well, I hope she gave you a discount on your particular tour. You discovered other places too, though, from their story that perhaps hadn't been previously identified. Is that right? What are you researching there?
Well, yes, not so much discovered. I retraced the route taken by the payroll consignment over the mountain they call Huacahuanyusca, which is an Aymara word, means dead cow. I don't know if it means that there was a dead cow up there or whether it's shaped like a dead cow, but they went down the other side. The trail, unbelievably, is still there today, and 100 years later is still used by local llama herders to go from place to place.
You did your own trip with llama herders.
Yes,
you?
I'm a bit of a Bolivia fan, as you can see. Quite separately from this, I walked with a group of llama herders carrying blocks of salt from the great Uyuni Salt Lake over the Andes, not far from here, actually. And that is another fantastic reason to go to that corner of Bolivia. If you go in late May, June, through to early July, which is the dry season, you stand every chance of encountering a bunch of 30 or so grumpy, rumbling llamas being cajoled into carrying blocks of salt.
Is that something you recommend to do, to go walking in the Andes, or what's the best way of getting a flavour of the Bolivian mountains?
Oh, well, obviously to walk. I mean, walking, I love walking anyway, but walking is the only way to see mountains like that. And the southwest corner, actually, there is a very good alternative. If you go to a town called Uyuni, U-Y-U-N-I, Uyuni, and look around, there will be little mini travel agents who will take you on what they call the Southwest Circuit, which is the most fabulous 3 or 4 day circuit by Land Cruiser. And if you get, you know, half a dozen people together, it's not expensive. You first of all go out across the Uyuni Salt Lake. Can you imagine this? The largest salt flat in the world. 80 miles across, 50 miles wide, 12,500 feet above sea level, and flat as a pancake, dazzling white. And then you go to the volcanoes along the Chilean border, which are some of the most beautiful volcanoes and mountain scenery I've seen in my whole life.
Thinking of Chile and Argentina, where Butch and Sundance obviously also lived and travelled and robbed, where would you highlight, particularly thinking of that area of Patagonia in Argentina or across the border in Chile and Patagonia, where would you highlight people to go
well,
there?
Well, going to Patagonia is a huge area, 500,000 square miles. Mm-hmm. But for me, and this is really nothing to do with Butch and Sundance, the highlight of the whole lot is the Torres del Paine National Park in southern Chile, which is sort of sugarloaf mountains and fabulous trekking country. That's on the Chilean side. A similar national park on the or area on the Argentine side is called Mount Fitzroy. When you get to Argentina, you'll find that they call it Fitzroy because they all have a lisp. Yes. But Fitzroy region on the Argentine side, those two, for any mountain lover, will just take your breath away.
Well, I will aim to get to Fitzroy, I might say that, when I can. I can, but certainly endorse your choice of Torres del Paine. I had a fantastic time there a few years ago. John, for the moment, thank you very much indeed. Now, a few weeks ago on Excess Baggage, we discussed what we meant by sustainable travel, which prompted many emails on the subject, some taking issue with the various definitions and ideas we discussed. Then we talked quite generally around the topic, but today we'll focus on a thread of sustainable travel that's at the really hard end of the debate: human rights and freedom of expression. Our ever-increasing awareness of the many and tangled issues affecting the places we visit makes politically ethical travel a fascinating and significant topic. There are, of course, many views on this most complex of subjects, and it's not always easy to be completely objective about it. Joining us now with her personal view on ethical travel is Lucy Popescu, whose book, The Good Tourist, An Ethical Traveller's Guide, is just published. Lucy, welcome. You worked for many years with PEN, the writers' organisation dedicated to freedom of expression, and you sat on the Foreign Office's Freedom of Expression panel for 5 years. And you've travelled widely yourself, of course. How do you define ethical travel?
Basically, I wanted to build on the idea of sustainable travel and responsible travel and bring in the idea of human rights. I wanted to share the experience, you know, of the stories that I learned while I was at Penn, while I was working on freedom of expression, the stories of writers and journalists who were imprisoned often for many years. And I wanted to share on that, but also to share the idea that we can help, we can all help with this. By doing something on the return of our holiday, we can join an organisation like Amnesty, we can write a letter of appeal, we can boycott a retailer that deals in cotton that's you know, been harvested using slave labour. And I just wanted to build on that idea, I suppose. And I hope the book serves as an introduction to human rights in many of these tourist destinations.
I mean, one of the things that's tricky is deciding which country one might feel is appropriate to visit. High-profile campaigns bring some countries to the wider world's attention, South Africa in the apartheid years, of course, Chile under Pinochet, and then Burma more recently, perhaps. But there are many countries. I was looking on the website for the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture this morning, and there are, I think they list about 100 countries that are routinely almost practising torture. That's a vast number of countries that one might be thinking of visiting. How can we ever, as travellers, make an objective decision on where we should go or whether we should?
Well, I actually came full circle on this, and you mentioned Burma. And when I started writing my chapter on Burma, I believed that one should boycott travel. But delving a bit deeper and talking to people inside, you know, who worked inside Burma, but also those people who were living in exile, and, you know, researching a bit deeper, I realised that one can actually go and one could travel independently out there. I mean, one of the biggest fears about travel to Burma is that the money just goes straight into the regime's coffers.
Yeah.
Of course, you might go there and that might still happen. But as long as you're become aware of what's going on, you can come back, you can spread the word, you can join organisations that are campaigning for change in Burma. And some actually say that the Saffron Revolution that happened last year, when the monks and local protesters took to the streets, was actually caused, you know, because of interaction with tourists. And although that wasn't a great outcome in that many people died, it did bring our attention back to Burma. It brought our attention back to the human rights activists, the writers, the journalists who are in prison there. And I know when I was at Penn, for many years, we worked very hard to raise the profile of a lot of these writers and journalists. And the media weren't particularly interested, the press weren't particularly interested. Burma didn't change for years on end. The last sort of uprising before this was in 1988. So suddenly it brought the world's attention back. And some would say that was also sparked by interaction with tourists, by travellers going there. And of course, Burma was very opened its doors very late to tourists. It was only in 1996 that the regime began to encourage travel to Burma.
What's the experience like for a tourist? How can one travel there? What will one see? But how can one travel there ethically?
Well, I think it's about you know, not going on the more luxury cruises or staying in the big hotels. It's going a little bit off the beaten track. It's hiring local guides when possible. It's staying in small family-run guest houses. I think that's the way that you can hopefully ensure that you know, your money isn't going straight into the regime's coffers. Mm-hmm.
Okay, just thinking that I was looking in on the chapter, your chapter about Burma, and you recall that in 2005, Tony Blair, then Prime Minister, and as well as leaders of the opposition, actually said people shouldn't travel to Burma. The regime would be, if you like, endorsed or supported by anybody going there. So you say you come full circle on that. And is that something? Do you see a shift in the way government attitudes might be to places like Burma as to whether getting those insights is important?
Well, I think sometimes just boycotting a country is just too blunt an instrument, and that, you know, one has to think of, you know, almost be creative in the ways one puts pressure on a regime or on a you know, repressive state. And it was actually, you know, that you, if by boycotting a country, you're actually harming the people, because they may rely on tourism for their food, and it's often the poorest of people who rely on tourism are the ones that you're hurting by boycotting a country. And also, you can begin to see, I know in particular Burma, the regime there likes to keep things hidden from tourists, and they're very good at that. But, you know, if you delve a bit deeper, if you read about you read about Burma, or you visit some of the websites dedicated to alleviating repression and human rights in Burma, you can find your way in.
Tell me, you cover various places. Some of them perhaps are less obvious in a way than Burma. One being the Maldives, which by all accounts is the most beautiful place to visit. It has a human rights record that has been questioned. There have been recent elections there. Tell me about visiting the Maldives and the story of human rights there recently.
Well, Maldives was one of the sort of main countries I wanted to cover in the book, because it does present, when you look at the brochures, you see sand, sea, you know, pristine islands. But where are the people in the brochures? And you know, I wanted that. You know, I don't think many people know that the islands have been governed by the same President Gayoom for 30 years, mm-hmm. and that there have been accusations of corruption. The fact that there's an enormous wealth has been generated, but that it just, you know, the islanders don't see that. They're living in poverty. You know, there's malnutrition there, and the money's just ending up in a few hands of those who are friendly with the government there. Also, there is they were very repressive about press freedoms.
Right.
So often journalists would be imprisoned and locked up. And what I discovered in the 90s, again when I was working at Penn, was that writers and activists were being tortured, and we were hearing these accounts mm-hmm. of torture. And the amazing thing is you can be on one island in this the most amazing luxury, and overlooking your island overlooks another island which is a prison island,
right.
and where torture is going on. While you're lying on the beach, someone could be in a tin drum left on a baking beach. That's a form of torture. But why I'm particularly glad you brought up the Maldives is that I hope they're on the brink of change.
Right.
And just in the last 2 days, we've discovered that Mohamed Nasheed, who was someone that we campaigned for at Penn in the early 90s because he was a political prisoner, has been elected president. And this is changing a 30-year regime, and I think offers real hope for the future. So I'm hoping that Maldives is going to be a success story. And it also shows, because Mohamed would come to England, he would always be talking about what was going on in the Maldives, trying to get people interested, trying to, you know, get people to write about what was going on. And I think this shows how by spreading the word, one can affect change.
As you say, one of the important things is wherever one might be sitting in a hotel or on a bus or on a coach, as a traveller, if one is consciously thinking about what's going on over there, whether, as you say, in the Maldives, on the other island, which might be a prison island, to be conscious of that and think about that before the trip, during the trip, and after it is important. One that you mentioned in the book, both Australia and the USA, which might surprise some people, sharing the company of places like Burma and Iran. In the US, slave labour features. Now, that's something I hadn't realised was such a big issue. Tell me a bit more about that. That's particularly in the South.
Well, that's with the fruit farms, and there are a number of migrant workers that are paid a pittance and are just treated in an appalling way. And there are a number of organisations that are trying to combat what they call modern day slavery. with the US as well, I wanted to bring up other issues like the death penalty, issues that, you know, we know about the war in, on, you know, Iraq, and US has been condemned for that. But I wanted to pick up on these other issues like the fruit farmers and like the death penalty. You know, America still has, I think, around 36 states that are, that use the death penalty. And in 30 years, over 1,000 people have been executed in the United States. And you know, the United States is one of the most popular destinations in the world. Sure. It's in the top three. So it's about being aware of that.
Well, I mean, one the sort of general question, I guess, is that journalists like yourself have been there researching and writing about countries, and particularly about the difficult issues. Does it make a difference, the motive of one's travelling, whether you're going for purely for a holiday or on business or as a journalist, as a human rights activist?
Well, I think what I was trying to build on was this idea with the environmental eco issues, where we want to offset our carbon footprint by investing in trees or other projects. I wanted, the book isn't supposed to deter travel. It's supposed to say, go in with your eyes open, learn about the country, have a fuller picture of the country. And then I give very specific things that they can do on their return to help a people or to help a place if there is suffering going on.
John, I mean, you've travelled all over the world, in Asia. We were talking earlier about South America and Chile, Argentina, which in recent history were held under military regimes. When you visited Chile under the Pinochet regime, how did you address that?
Well, it's very interesting what Lucy says, actually, because I always felt that you can't really have a view on a country until you've been there, until you've talked to the ordinary people who live there. And that's what I did in Chile and Argentina in 1979, which was at the very height of the disappearances under Pinochet and Galtieri. Mm-hmm. And I met families who had lost, you know, their family members had disappeared and were never seen again. And I was actually arrested, not because I'd done anything wrong, but I was arrested
in
Argentina for taken in for a couple of hours and questioned really quite aggressively, even though I've, you know, done nothing wrong. So I felt it, I experienced it, and I spoke to people, of course, who had experienced it even more than I had. And so I gained, you know, a view of what was going on there at that time. I was travelling, as you say, in a sort of low-key way, not supporting the regime in any way, not staying in expensive hotels. I wouldn't anyway. But so I didn't feel I was in any way endorsing those regimes. But I came back and was able to talk about them with a little bit more knowledge.
Okay, well, thank you, Lucy Popescu and John Pilkington. And I guess the message is to travel with our eyes wide open, and we'd appreciate your views on ethical travel. Next week, travel and mental health, and the transformation of human language in the Brazilian jungle. In the meantime, a very good morning to you.